The British Broadcasting Corporation presents London Letter by MacDonald Hastings. In this program, every week at this time, MacDonald Hastings gives you the feel of life here in London, tells you the stories Londoners are telling each other, and highlights the personalities in the news. London Letter by MacDonald Hastings.
This is MacDonald Hastings from London. Through the grey, bomb-scarred streets of London this week, another soldier followed the processional route which General Eisenhower travelled a few weeks ago. The triumphal drive from the old city boundaries to the Lord Mayor's Palace of Guildhall, which is London's traditional way of honouring the great men of the world. Once again, the London pavements were thick with cheering people. Once again, a smiling, slightly embarrassed man in an open car saluted the crowds who surged through the cordons of police and shinned up lampposts and buildings to shout him on his way. Once again, the Lord Mayor of London, in all the pomp of his ceremonial robes, with his sheriffs, his aldermen, his guildsmen, and his liveried retainers about him, once again, the Lord Mayor of London waited in the impressive old Guildhall to honour a guest of London, to give him the compliments of its citizens, and to invite him to put his signature immediately after the name of Dwight Eisenhower in the Golden Book, which is the most distinguished visiting book in the world. Once again, a soldier gave his modest report of victory in one of the decisive campaigns of the war. And yet, this soldier, honored now with the great soldiers of history, was a stranger. When Eisenhower drove through London, he was greeted by the people who'd shared the smoke and noise of battle with him. His loose-limbed walk and his deprecating smile was as familiar to the Londoners as the bomb holes in Piccadilly and Winston Churchill's cigar. His battles were fought on our home ground. Not this soldier, who followed in Eisenhower's footsteps along London's triumphal route this week. Most of the Londoners had never even seen him. And the battles he talked about were fought and won in a distant country under conditions which few Londoners could even conceive. General Sir William Slim, fresh from the conquest of Burma, having rehoisted the British flag in Rangoon, with his army poised at the gateway between the Indian Ocean and the Pacific, Slim had returned to London to hand in his report. As I watched General Slim drive in triumph through the London streets, his face tanned leather-coloured by the sun and the folds of his skin dried into crow's feet by the fierce jungle heat, I remembered how only a year ago his forces had been christened the Forgotten Army. The eyes of the Allies were fixed so intently on the great battle raging on the continent that Mr. Churchill had to remind us that at that time the British Army in Burma, the 14th Army under General Slim, was engaging and killing more Japs than all the rest of the ground forces in the Eastern Theatre put together. And later, as late as the time of the Yalta Conference, it was said that General Marshall had to remind the Russian General Staff that the Anglo-Americans were fighting not only on two fronts, but two enemies as well. And as the American Chief of Staff, he had to resist the suggestion that reinforcements from the West should be brought from the British forces fighting under General Slim in Burma. Slim was fighting two enemies too. The Japs and the people who didn't realize the magnitude of the campaign on his hands. He was fighting in a disease-infested, roadless, utterly primitive country where distances were on a scale unheard of in European warfare, where the trackless vegetation was so thick that he couldn't use his guns except at point-blank range, and where his men had to fight not in divisions or in regiments, but in sections, handfuls of half a dozen. Slim told himself how under those conditions he had to advance 1,500 miles in 6 months and kill every Jap in the way as he went. But he did it. As it's happened so often before in British history, the unrecognized general and the Forgotten Army did it. And one day, as London did this week, we suddenly wake up and realize that while we were thinking about something else, a great man has been adding glory to British arms and flying the flag at the other end of the world. Now, Slim's name links with Alexander and Montgomery. A staff officer said to me only the other day that he was willing to bet that Slim's Burma campaign would be a classic military textbook for years to come. And the London newspapers now are filled with the news from the Pacific and the deeds of the million men in the British forces and the great British fleet fighting with you in the Far Eastern theatre. And with it comes the hope that the climax won't be long delayed. Slim, by pushing back the Japs in Burma, reoccupying Rangoon and massing his forces while the monsoons are on in preparation for the return of campaigning weather in October, Slim has completed his phase of the Anglo-American strategical plan, as MacArthur, by reoccupying the Philippines, has completed his part. Now, Slim's 14th Army is looking towards the Malay Peninsula and Singapore. MacArthur, with a firm hold on the Central Pacific, with advanced air-striking bases in the Gilbert Islands to support him, and Nimitz with an all-powerful Anglo-American fleet controlling the seas, MacArthur and Nimitz must surely now be eyeing the islands of Nippon itself. My own guess, for what it's worth, is that the main assault on Japan will be largely an American affair, in the same way that the Burma campaign has been largely a British affair. The British job, probably with the Australians, who've been playing a big part in New Guinea and Borneo, our part will be to clear Malaya, Singapore, and the Dutch possessions in the Indies. But we all hope, too, in Britain, that our forces will take a part in the landings on Japan proper, in the same way that America sent a force under General Stilwell to Burma. It's not only a matter of pride, it's a tradition that's worth nurturing. That Englishmen and Americans fight their wars side by side together. When General Slim addressed the City Fathers of London this week, he delighted his audience with a special compliment for the Cockney fighting men. Wherever the Londoners go, he said, they bring a resilience of spirit and an indomitable humour. And it's things like that that make life out there in Burma possible. The words delighted the Londoners because it's a personal grumble of every soldier. And London, with its 10 million population, produces the larger part of our fighting strength. It's a good-humoured complaint of the London soldiers that nobody ever gives them a pat on the back. The publicity, they say, always goes to the Scottish troops, the Canadians, the Australians, the New Zealanders, and the crack units like the Guards, instead of the old bread-and-butter British county regiments, regiments like the Middlesex, the Surreys, the Kents. So, when General Slim complimented the Londoners fighting in the jungle, well, I looked everywhere among the crowd to find a good London type who'd fought in the long Burma campaign. Well, I found a 14th Army man, all right. But when I asked him what part of London he came from, he said,
"Oh, come on, I'm no Londoner. Nice to ask where I come from. But I fought with a General Slim, if that's what you want."
So the London soldiers are done out of their publicity again.
With the name MacDonald Hastings, you shouldn't mind.
But this is a London letter.
Well, London's run by Scots. And America, too, so they say.
I hope the Cohens and the Kellys can't hear you. Well, Jock, when did you get back from Burma?
About this time last year. You see, I was due for repatriation.
Repatriation, why?
Because I had done my 4.5 years service abroad.
In Burma?
No. I started in Palestine with the Black Watch in February 1940. Then I went to Egypt, then Somaliland, then Aden, then Egypt again, then to Crete. We didn't stay in Crete very long that time.
You mean that was the German airborne invasion?
It was. Well, then I went back to the Middle East, then Syria, then Tobruk.
During the siege?
That's it. We relieved the Australians, and then it was us that broke out and joined up with the main body of the 8th Army when Tobruk was relieved. Well, then I went back to Egypt.
You've done a bit of travelling during 4 years, haven't you, Jock?
A regular troop steward, but I've nearly finished. After Egypt, we went to India, jungle training for 15 months, and then I was transferred to an anti-tank gun battery, and I was there in Burma. Put me over to the offensive after the monsoons in 1943. That was the beginning of the show to drive straight to Rangoon.
2 years later, how far did you get to Rangoon?
Our lot started 30 miles inside the frontier. We pushed on a bit. I went to hospital 9 months later.
And the offensive then really got cracking after you'd gone to hospital.
That's what my mother-in-law says.
Oh, married, are you?
This year.
How old are you?
25. I joined up when I was 20.
Still, you have to be young for this jungle fighting.
And you feel 10 years older when you come out of it.
Food difficult?
Sometimes it's all right, when the rations get up to you. Or drop them from there. Their supplies were good. But the Japs, the nasty little snakes, used to get round behind us and cut us off. Then we had to live on a bit of rice, an onion and a potato, and what we could scrounge. And at the same time, the mosquitoes were feeding on us. It's an awful country, you know.
I can believe it.
During the day, it's 105 in the shade, I should say. And during the night, it's so cold that when you wake up, there's ice in the water.
Do you carry much kit?
One pair of light trousers, one shirt, a mosquito net, that's all.
Sleeping tents?
Mostly. You make huts. You cut down a few trees, make a frame with bamboo poles, and lace the poles with elephant grass. It's pretty waterproof, sometimes.
Do you get bothered by wild animals?
Not much. The jackals used to come through our camps, screaming and shouting. But they didn't matter. The only wild animals we worried about were the little yellow men.
The Jap?
They used to attack us at night. They wouldn't come out in open and fight, not they. They always fought the sly and crafty way.
What? How do you mean?
The sort of thing they do is to creep up to our bad wire at night and hang cans on it. The idea was to make us fire at the noise and give our presents away. And they let us have it. They were always playing tricks like that. If you had a bird calling, you had to watch out. The Japs used to imitate them. And sometimes they come up to the wire and call it in English. If one of the chaps was taken in by it and went out to see what was up, they split their throat. I like to kill every one of them personally.
Have you killed any?
I've put a shell from a gun through a troop carrier, stuffed full of them, at point blank range. It was night and we could only see the shadow, but we fired. And then they got us. They laid their mortars on our gun, flash, and in 2 shots they knocked out the gun. Killed one of their chaps and wounded another. That's what the fighting's like out there. You always feel as if you're alone, just a handful of you in the jungle. And every now and again, you get into a quick
and you go on hacking your way forward through on the grass, a few years at a time.
And fighting like that, we've come to Rangoon. By the way, Jock, you've been in the war since the beginning. Why haven't you got up any medals?
The ribbons are worn out. I'll get some more later.
The ribbons have worn out. You wouldn't know it, Jock, but that'd make a grand title for a book. A book about men like you. Till next week, this is MacDonald Hastings from London.
That was a recording of London Letter by MacDonald Hastings, presented weekly from the BBC in London. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.